It's my pleasure this afternoon to introduce Jeff Wong. I was looking back at my email, and I think the first email I got from you was in 2009, when you were doing some work on query reformulations with EFSI. And so Jeff has been publishing in the human-computer, at the intersection of HCI and IR for about a decade now. And it was a pleasure working with Jeff. Many of you have had him here as an intern. I'm looking at people in software engineering, in games, in HCI, and IR. Jeff interacted really with a lot of us here. I also had the pleasure of being his co-advisor for his PhD thesis with Jake Wobrock. And it's you know, it's a pleasure to have a PhD student get a faculty position at a place as spectacular as Brown. And it's a pleasure to host him on his first return visit, I think, since he's been a professor there. And what he's going to talk about today is four separate projects that he's doing around a theme of understanding user interaction with systems and using that to leverage great new interactions. So,
Thank you, Jeff. Oh, thanks for that really wonderful introduction. Hey, everyone. It's so good to be back here. It's good to see some familiar faces. And what I want to do today is show you some of the work we've been doing in my research group at Brown and tell you a story about how we've been using some really easy to collect behavior data to make systems that would otherwise not be possible. So that's what I'm going to talk about. And my story actually starts here. So I've got a photo here of UW and Microsoft Research. And many of you have probably, haven't talked to you, seen me in this building before, and that's because I've been an intern many times here before. One of the recruiters said I hold the record for the most Microsoft internships, so consider me your biggest fan. So I was really lucky that during my PhD at UW, I got a chance to come here a lot to do internships and work with a lot of great people. I'll tell you kind of one of the earliest times I interned. I was interviewing for a research internship with the search UX team, and the manager actually said, "Hey, come on down and bring some ideas of things you want to work, some UX stuff ideas you had that you wanted to come up with that relate to search." And so what I did is I opened up the Bing search engine and I just like sat and stared at it for a little while to come up with ideas. I was just like, the most like naive way to come up with ideas. I came up with three ideas actually. Two of them turned out to be kind of duds, but one was turned out to be good. So the two that didn't work out were what are the ideas? One was to come up with a way to show search results in multiple columns. So I was deciding, oh, screens are getting wider, and let's just have four columns of search results. That's a great idea. So that was one of them. Another one was, show the search results above the fold, so above the that are visible right away, like in 0 seconds, basically, and then take as much time as possible to do the other search results after people are starting to interact with the ones at the top. Maybe they click on something and come back, and we mess with the ones that they don't see. So that was the idea. Other idea. That was really hard to do. And the last one, which actually turned out to be a good project idea, was to I noticed there's a way you can actually track the mouse movements when I was using the search results page in JavaScript, and to kind of send that data back to the server without anyone really noticing that it was a very like subtle way to collect really rich interaction data. And so this is kind of what I was doing. I was just like messing around with the search engine, and I was like, oh, well, I need to like move the mouse around. And so I did that, and I tried to figure out on my own like how to nab this data and what it would look like. And even besides the mouse cursor, I noticed that you could even track the like scrolling on the page. So that was also kind of interesting to me, too. So I was able to come and intern, and I worked with Craig Miller and Ryan White that summer on this. And this actually led to a few other a few other ideas based on this. So we were able to get a good number of kind of applications out of it. So understanding search behavior, like what people were doing on the page, identifying where they were looking, so trying to look at the correlation between eye gaze and where people were pointing, trying to compute some better search result relevance on the search results by kind of simulating what the scores would be and what would be relevant to the users. And this one was led by George Wisher, which was clustering different types of searchers. How did they, were they people that were more likely to examine the page or look for, just go from top to bottom and just stop on the first result they thought was interesting. So we got a lot out of that one initial seed of the idea, and I guess I heard now search the cursor tracking stuff is being at a used at a large search company. So that's really good to hear. But one thing that I really want to do after this work is something that was not just about kind of improving search, but also things that directly users can use. So something that's more than a feature or parameter. I wanted to build things that change how people do things today. So I came up with some kind of principles of what type of work I was really interested in as I finished my PhD. And I thought that I needed these principles because otherwise it was really easy for me to just continue doing what I was doing before and to just like think about like what's the next paper to write and never really have like a long-term vision. So I got a kind of moment to think about that. And there were two insights that I had that were now my guiding principles when we decide how to do research. One is that I spent a lot of time looking at behavioral data at Bing and Google and Yahoo. And the kind of main lesson I got from that is that everyone's so different. But every time we try to make things perform better by tailoring the data to that person, things seem to work better for them. And that seems to always be kind of a good seed for an idea. And so the easy to collect, passively collected behavior data, the data that we don't have to ask people to give us, that we can just sense or collect interactions data we can collect easily, is sometimes that can make things that have not been possible before. And so I think that's a huge opportunity that we can get a lot of more mileage out of. So that's one principle. And the other principle is more like philosophical, is that when I was not interning, I had an unusual situation where I had a lot of freedom during my PhD. And so I had a secret life as a startup founder. And so I co-founded two companies at different points. To make a long story short, one startup, we spent all our investors' monies and released something that nobody wanted. It was actually like an early version of what you might think of as Pokemon Go, but much less cool. It was about collecting Pokemon. It was Pokemon Go without Pokemon. So that didn't work out. It was a waste of money. And in the second startup, with some other friends, we did the opposite. We actually got a lot of customers and users signing up, and we won demo competitions, but we never kind of finished our product. So I went back to finish this PhD thing, which it turned out to be a good thing anyways. But the thing that I learned is that I really love to have people use the stuff that I make, especially people that I don't ask to use it. So they're not doing it as a study. If they just use it and I'm like, wow, like they're really enjoying, or this is changing how they're doing something, that's really amazing. So people who are using your products on your own, when they can do something they haven't been able to do before, that's like a way to completely change how things are done. That's something that's really exciting for me. So that's how I started thinking about HCI research, because in HCI, we're always thinking about evaluation. How do we show that this work is good? And so I decided that my new metric would be if it's adopted by people who I didn't make use the thing and who I think should be using it, and they're using it in a new way, then I'm successful. So that's kind of the principle. So I want to distribute products that transform how we do things. And I also want to use the word product, and it's not, I think in CS we often use the word system, but to me products sound like things that are you release that are ready to use right out of the box. So products are things you put out there and people that actually want to use them can use them, whereas systems I feel like are kind of one step not fully finished. They might not have the documentation, it might not be at the same level. So that's why I like to think of them as products, so things that people actually want to use. So I try to apply some of these principles back to my earlier works. So I was thinking, a lot of the cursor tracking work was about how can we use cursor tracking to kind of substitute for eye tracking to do things on a scalable way that can figure out where people are looking. But instead, what if we just, instead of substituting for eye tracking, we actually make eye tracking better using cameras that people already have on their laptops and mobile devices. So it's kind of taking these cursor tracking lessons that we learned and giving it to users as an aid to eye tracking. So that's where the first idea came about. This project called WebGazer is online eye tracking using webcams. And I thought it's a great area to get to personalize, because people's faces and eyes look different. They look at things differently, so their gaze behaviors are different. So I think we can take advantage of a lot of this kind of very subtle forms of data to improve eye tracking. So this is kind of a blown up image of someone looking at different parts of the screen. And one thing that you'll notice is that the pupil is in different parts of the, in different areas of the eye. depending on where they're looking. So the location of the pupil relative to the position of the eye gives some indicator of kind of the direction they're looking, but we don't know exactly where they're looking on the screen. So we need some tricks to figure out mapping between the eye and the screen. So this is the first trick that we came up with, which is probably the most obvious. So we just collect data as people are clicking on things on the screen. So in some of my earlier work, I've discovered that when people are clicking or about to click, that's when the mapping between your eye and positions on the screen is the strongest, when the alignment is the best. So whenever you click, it knows what your eye looks like, it turns it into a set of features, and it stores that those features map to an exact coordinate on the screen. So even later on, when you're not clicking, it can kind of interpolate in the screen where you might be looking, because it's got kind of a feature vector of your eye and can kind of figure out what's the closest in the past that your eye looks like and where you were looking before. So that's the first trick, and worked OK. The second trick was there's this lag between when you look at something and when you click on it. So this is the click gaze lag. We've studied this in pretty good detail before, and there's this kind of distribution of how long it takes, usually about like 300 to 800 milliseconds before you click on something and you look at it. So there's this lag, and everyone is different. So you can actually, this is like another area we can personalize it. So we're trying to figure out what's the best number to kind of shift this click gaze lag to get slightly more accurate predictions of where you're looking. So that's trick number two. And the third trick is, even when you're not clicking on things, if you're just moving the mouse, the recent areas in which you move the mouse could have correlations to where you're looking. Depends on the person. And this is a less important feature, but you can weight it appropriately and use this as another set of interactions that can help improve the prediction of where someone's looking. So these are kind of three tricks that we put together. And we create something called WebGazer. Yes. Yeah, Mary.
Does knowing the layout of what's, if you can, you know, screen scrape and know the layout of what's on the screen, mm-hmm. presumably that would help too, because, you know, presumably there's certain areas of the screen that have like widgets or text, and there's some areas that are like dead space, and presumably people don't spend a lot of time looking at dead space, so
yeah.
If the calibration's a little off and it looks like they're looking at dead space, presumably you would, you know, probabilistically snap it to the nearest
right.
widget or something. Is that something you...
That's a great point. Yeah, so there's like a lot of research on like saliency, like an image where people look, or just on a screen where people are more likely to look. We actually wanted to just do an extreme example of something that's just generic that will work without looking at the content of the page, but definitely combined with the content, it would do much better for sure. And this is something that we wanted to work on any page, not just search page. So it's really hard to sometimes interpret some web page and what is really going on there. But that's a really good point. Yeah, thanks for the question. Any other questions so far? Okay. So we put together WebGazer. It's made of several components, very modular. So you can use different eye detector libraries. There's three right here that's compatible with. CLM trackers seem to work the best for us. There's different models for regression. Ridge regression is one that works well with a few number of training points. Like when you start to use a page and you don't have any clicks or mouse movements, then it can already do some sort of prediction reasonably well.
What are you regressing?
There's a mapping between the features from your eye and positions on the screen. So that's basically, as you're using the page, it's forming training data. So imagine like a website that you would need to click a lot on, like your online Outlook email thing, requires you to use it. And so that's where you're getting the training data.
Are you bootstrapping that with priors from like a population? Or?
Yeah. So the current version doesn't, but that should probably be a good idea. I think the idea was like, what's the most extreme personalization we can do that only works for you? And sometimes when using data even before for the same person doesn't work well because the lighting conditions are different, their heads tilted, they're laying on the bed. So we've been trying to just do it for like single sessions here. But there must be something we can use as priors. And the last part is, this is just a pure JavaScript library. There's nothing to install. You can put it on any page. It's just a couple lines of code. And it's the nice thing is it's fairly scalable. You can actually have 100 people use it at the same time. So this is a little video of my PhD student, Alexandra, using WebGazer. The red dot is where the prediction of where she's looking. And in this example, she's just looking at images on an image search engine. But in a second, let me just jump to that maybe. In a second, you'll see that. So she's using an email client, and so this requires her to actually interact with it. And then as she, the more interactions that you get, the more training data that the eye tracking model has. So it works on pretty much any web page. And then, of course, we want to know how accurate it is. So we did run a series of tests. So I'll just tell you straight up, it's not as good as an infrared eye tracker. Like a specialized device is better. And I don't know if we'll ever get as good. We compared against this Tobii device. This is actually just like a more like consumer-oriented device called the iX. And so this task here was to just look at kind of questions that you had to look at in a column. So you can notice that this is the first chart is the x-axis, and the second chart is the first chart is the x-coordinate, and the second chart is the y-coordinate. So the green is kind of the ground truth, and you can tell they were kind of looking at the same place at the x-axis. They were looking down a column, and the y-axis was going up. So basically, we're looking from column to column here, right? And you can see the web gazer prediction, which is blue, is somewhat correlated with the green, which is the IX, right? So here, the user eye is kind of somewhat correctly predicted compared to the Tobii eye tracker here. It kind of screws up here a little bit, so I'm not sure what happens. And then here, they're just like looking around. Maybe they're like finishing up this task and then exit. So in general, I think we get about an inch to an inch and a half of accuracy, like an error on average, which is not good enough probably to look at this exact word they're looking at, but we could probably figure out kind of the region they're in. So there's some kind of interesting applications, and one thing we want to do is can we kind of replicate some of the earlier studies in information retrieval? So there were several studies that used eye tracking back then. So what would it look like if we just did these studies with WebGazer? We just put it on Mechanical Turk, and we did it in like an hour. So we basically replicated a lot of the charts in several papers. I only have one example here. But in general, the patterns seem to be somewhat comparable. So the conclusions we'd have gotten would have been about the same. The numbers would have been a little different. There were some differences, for sure. And it might have been because some of these were older studies, might have been the change of the layout of the page. We tried to use the original layout of these SERPs as much as possible, but sometimes it was not possible. So we've got this paper where we replicate this Cottrell and Guan paper, the Viewser paper by Eugene Edelstein, and one more paper. I think it's the George Buescher paper about ads, how people look at ads. So these are the three papers that we replicated. So if you're interested in that, you can look there. But I think what's more interesting is sometimes if other people can use this. So we actually put this as an open source project on GitHub, and so there's a decent number of people that have like starred or forked it. So forked is like when you can branch the code in a way. And there's people that have sent us things that they've done, which were really cool. This one is called Globe Gaze, where you can control this globe using your eyes. So if you look to the right of the globe, it rotates the globe. So you're always looking, whatever you look at always kind of rotates in the view, which is kind of cool. This one is a Tesla app in automobiles. Let's see. Let's just go to. So I think it's like an app you use in your car, which sounds kind of dangerous if you use touch, but maybe you can use it with your eyes. So here he's, I think, looking at like distances or how much battery life it takes to go to different parts of the road. And you can see it's a little bit jumpy here, but you can kind of figure out what part of the road he's looking at. And it kind of controls what things pop out on the screen. Probably still a bad idea to use in the car, but but who knows. Anyways, so that's one way we could use user interactions. And I'll talk about another way we've been using online interactions next. And I'm just curious if anyone has any questions about WebGazer. Yeah, Paul.
So you mentioned you were doing the calibration just based on clicks, right? So presumably it works well with touchscreen devices then too, because you'll still have the clicks.
So we tried a phone. So that was the next step. So it works well, pretty decently on a tablet. On a phone, it works poorly. And there's a couple of factors for that. One is you don't touch as much as you move the cursor. There's like very few touches relative to mouse movements. And the second is the screen is much smaller. So we have, let's say, even if we have like 1-inch error, that's still a lot. That's like half the screen. So we tried a few. Also, the performance is not as good. So we actually had to do a worse model on the phone to get it as performant. And so it's just not quite ready. We're going to try again maybe in a few years. So yeah, we actually spent a lot of time on that, and it failed. And we have nothing to show for it. Any other questions? OK. So the next project is another way of using online interactions. And it came up from a different, completely different idea. We created this data set of computer science professors in, now it's 70 schools, but basically a lot of the research universities in Canada and the United States. And this data set was just like a fun course project. We crowdsourced it, and then we fixed it up quite a bit. But it turned out a lot of people really enjoyed using this data to actually make like important department decisions about hiring trends, or like to justify to their provost. Apparently, all departments think can justify with this data that they're smaller compared to their peer institutions. So everyone's saying like, hey, we need to hire more in this area, or we need to we have the wrong kind of makeup of faculty compared to other universities. So we got about over 100,000 visitors to this page, and it was shared broadly. But the problem with the data set is the moment after we created it, it was immediately out of date because people switched jobs, they got promoted, they changed areas, and so forth. So it was like a nice data set with like, you know, people's degrees and stuff, which didn't change much, but there's like their university, their join year might change if they move, or their rank in their subfield change a lot. So the question that we want to ask is, how can we actually keep this data up to date? And the idea we had was, what if we host the data on a platform that actually asks the people that use the data to help fix it? So kind of crowdsourcing it back to the people. Because what we discovered is people on Mechanical Turk are not very good at maintaining this data. There's a lot of like subtle things in academia that people outside of academia don't know, like what a postdoc is, that a research fellow is different, you know, somewhat similar to a postdoc sometimes, or that a visiting assistant professor is different from an assistant professor, or that a chaired, like the Amazon professor of computer science is not someone working on at Amazon, right? It's just like all these things that we know implicitly that a lot of people don't. And so the idea is people that look at the data will be the best position to fix the data. But the thing is, you don't want to just randomly ask someone to fix some piece of data because they probably don't care or that know that much. And the insight we have is, well, we can collect the interactions they're doing on this page, like how they are filtering in a field, or if they, a lot of people will highlight names and copy and paste them to search for them names, or they'll move their mouse over some areas, or you know, search or sort a column, right? So all this interaction data we can collect and build a little bit of a profile for people. And oops, I'm going to show you this first. So as people are making these interactions, we can say like, okay, this person has copy and pasted many names out of Arizona State, so we're going to maybe they're interested in Arizona State, and maybe they notice that they've searched for human interactions in the column, and so maybe they're interested in that. So we start to build this profile. And after a little while, then that's when we pop up this message and say, hey, maybe you'd be interested in helping us fix some data. So this is a professor at Harvard. And so we want to know where they received their master's. And if we have some other data about their master's, we might give them as options. But here we just say, do you know where they received their master's? And the idea, the hypothesis we had is, if you're someone who has looked at a lot of faculty at Harvard, or you were interested in, you sorted by a field that this person was doing research in, then maybe you'd be more likely to know this person, or at least be interested in looking up information about this person. So that's our hypothesis. So we don't just want to ask any random user to review any piece of data. And so it turned out this hypothesis was true. When we ran an experiment, we compared different, you know, a group where we just randomly asked them to help fix things compared to if we kind of targeted them based on their profile. And it turned out that the people which we found an interest match for were 20 times as more off likely to help find the corrections for the data or review the data. And they were 5 times more accurate in fixing the data. So that was very promising. So that's kind of another use of interaction data, fairly subtle, and that actually helps maintain the data store we have. So I showed you so far 2 kind of systems where we're actually changing how people do things. We're changing how eye tracking works from a lab study to we can do remote studies, or we can do real-time gaze interactions with WebGazer. And with Drafty, we kind of want to change how we maintain data. So turn it into more of a wiki, but where we can target people to request to review the data based on their interests. So Then we started thinking, what are some other forms of really easy to collect data, the behavioral data? And obviously, mobile is one opportunity. So it's, you know, something you carry around with you all the time. So it's another source for really rich behavior footprints, right? So so then we started looking at projects here. This project is, the next one I'll talk about is sleep cultures, about changing how we improve our sleep. So I'll ask you guys a question. How many people here sleep every day? Okay, most of you.
And now, okay,
so you're all sleep addicts. How many people are completely satisfied with your sleep? Keep your hand up. Okay, so a lot fewer people, right? So it turns out a lot of people don't get kind of the quality of sleep that you want, that you think you can get, right? So there's many ways in which people kind of try to fix this, try to improve their sleep. On one hand are sleep apps. So there's the Microsoft Band is one. It has a sleep app component to it. But a lot of devices. This is actually my undergraduate student, Gina. She wore 5 sleep tracking devices and had 3 sleep apps and also the HelloSense pill and some other things on her bed, and she slept with all of them. So the thing with sleep apps is they're mainly descriptive. They tell you what happened. They'll tell you, did you, when you went to bed and all this information about you. They are a little bit less accurate. We don't know exactly how accurate they are. I'll show you some info about that in a second. But they're also not very clinical. There's no kind of clinician behind it. They don't give you any prescriptive information. Like, they don't recommend what you can do to sleep better. They just tell you, here's, how you slept, right? So it's all informational. On the other extreme is sleep clinics. So you might go to one of these, and they'll actually, it's called polysomnography. They'll attach a bunch of electrodes to you, and you might sleep there like one night or a few more nights. But it's really expensive. It's very intrusive. And then at the end, that clinician will tell you, may diagnose you with sleep apnea or if there's any major issues. But it's mainly for people with really intense sleep problems, right? So, so we looked at first how did these sleep apps do. And here's some of them. And you can see that these are all various sleep tracking apps or devices. The one on the bottom is called the AMI Motion Logger, which actually is a medically validated device. But it doesn't do kind of sleep staging. But you can actually see that it's better than random. So this is for a single night for the same person that same night. And the yellow is awake, the blue is they're sleeping. The dark blue is like when it says they were in deep sleep and there's different stages. But you can see there's some relationship, right, between them. It's not completely random. Yeah, it's we have this for a week, so you can, if anyone's interested, you can dig into that more. But it is somewhat variable. So that's one thing we looked at. The next thing is we noticed that with this data, you can actually collect a huge data set and actually start to do kind of large-scale things with them. We actually are pretty lucky. We're working with this company called UrbAndroid. They actually have the largest sleep app called Sleep as Android out there. I'm just curious, has anyone used it? Sleep as Android? Okay. They apparently have like 10 million downloads. And they sent us their data of 10 million nights of sleep. So it's like the largest set of sleep records ever. And this is actually one chart that they made out of this data. And so here's actually a question for you. Then these are, by the way, these are apps that you place, these are phones, apps that you place on your bed. So you put the phone in your bed and it tracks your movement and noise at night. But this is a chart that from this data set. And on the x-axis is the length of sleep, right? So you can see it goes from 6 hours, 40 minutes to 7 hours, 25 minutes. And the y-axis is a number. And so the question for you is, can you guess what this what the y-axis means? What is the label here that would go here normally?
Latitude.
Any other guesses?
Somebody like rolling.
Okay, so degrees of rolling.
Degree from your back or something.
Any other guesses? So is there, what would make someone vary about the sleep on average for a lot of people?
Daily.
About an hour. Daily. It's actually your first answer. It's actually the degrees from the equator.
Latitude.
Yeah. So it turns out, so everyone sleeps fairly different, right? There's actually, if you look at the data, some people just get a lot more sleep than others. Maybe they need more sleep. Some people are light sleepers that are woken up by noise a lot easier. Some people have just have different chronotypes. Some people are morning people versus night owls, right? So the people are very different, and so it's really hard to prescribe exactly something that works for everyone. And so what we developed is Sleep Coacher, which automatically generates these recommendations for improving sleep based on your own personal sensing data. So it works kind of in a cycle. We collect the data as you put your phone on your bed. The sensing data is collected, sent to our servers, and we start calculating a whole bunch of correlations on all the many, many sleep variables. But as we all know, correlation is not causation. You've probably heard that many times. So we actually need to actually do some interventions to see what is going to improve your sleep. So we actually need to run experiments on you. And so we generate a recommendation, we send it to you, and then we see the outcome. We can actually see if it improved your sleep or not, and then if it doesn't, then we try something else. So it's kind of a cycle like this.
Can you give an example of a recommendation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to go into it in more detail in a second. So first, the first step is taking this raw sensor data, converting into variables. So from here, we can start getting things like how long it took you to fall asleep, how many times you woke during the middle of the night, if you use the snooze, like how you'd use your alarms, or how many times an alarm went off, your subjective sleep rating when you wake up. There's how noisy things are. Is it the weekend, hours slept, how consistently you go to bed, and also whatever tags that a user wants to put in, you can, if they want to tag alcohol or caffeine or exercise or something. So that can also be part of this automatically computed correlation table. So that's the first step. The next step is then we pick the likely candidates that we think might be causal, and we run these experiments. So we do this kind of A-B-A-B type study to figure out which of these behavior actually kind of affect outcomes. So if the correlation is causal, then we change one variable this way, the other one should change that same direction. And that's how we can discover it's causal. And one thing we did notice is that the correlations are very different. So you can notice here that these are two different people. This one person, if they change their bedtime to earlier, if they make their bedtime earlier, that has a high correlation with their sleep rating. But this person is the opposite. A later bedtime has a high correlation with their sleep rating. So everyone is different based on these correlations. So you asked about the recommendations. So the recommendations were generated based on discussions with clinicians. So we actually had clinicians review all the recommendations. We said, here are kind of the patterns we're looking for. Here's the recommendation. So we've got this basically template text that we fill in with the actual numbers, right? So for example, on average, the noise level in your bedroom is something. We've noticed that when your room is noisy during the night, you tend to wake up more during the night. So on average, you wake up this many times per hour. For the next this many days, listen, try doing something to mitigate that. So these are specific recommendations to try to improve your sleep. And so we have a huge data set of these recommendations that we try. Then we have a slightly different text depending on which phase of study they're in. So the process generally identifying patterns and figure out how to make a reasonable recommendation for sleep. And so here are the results. The first thing that we found is a lot of people actually don't follow the recommendations. And I mean, we ran this on students, so they have important things to do, like they need to study for exams, so they can't sleep earlier, they need to go to really important parties. So two-thirds of the study population didn't even follow the recommendations 70% of the time. So they're practically not doing the study, right? If you are almost coin flip deciding whether or not to follow the recommendations. So that's kind of a bummer. There's no results there. But if for the people that did follow their recommendations more than two-thirds of the time, it seemed either there was some sort of positive improvement in the target variable that we were predicting for their sleep, right? So we predicted this would happen. It actually improved in the way we expected. So this is a good promising sign that we do have the ability to improve someone's sleep by providing these correlation powered recommendations. Yeah.
Is the improvement in these automatically measured variables or in the self-reported variables?
We kind of treat them as the same thing, I guess, but a lot of them were the automatic variables and and some of them were self. The only self-reported variable was actually
reports anybody who adheres to something, whether it's a true recommendation
right.
or not, right?
There might be a bias. Yeah. The only self-reported variable was your sleep rating when you wake up. So that was the only one variable that was, I guess, subjective in a way.
But the others are things like time to fall asleep or something.
Yeah, number of awakenings in the middle of the night, time to fall asleep. So these are less, technically you might be able to like delay yourself from falling asleep if you really wanted, but I think in general we assume that some of these variables are dependent variables. And as part of this, we like I think one thing we realized is we didn't actually force people to follow recommendations. I guess we didn't really push them that hard. We just said, you know, we're going to make recommendations, and you know, you can try use them to try to improve your sleep. So that's maybe one flaw of the study, but it was still kind of surprising to see like a lot of people would just like follow them the recommendations like half the time, which is basically like not doing it. So that's the result we have so far there. Any questions about Sleep Poacher? Yeah.
Another one. On the awakenings, is that something that, you know, kind of similar to the click study, if people are interacting with their phone, do you count that as awake, or what is the, or is it all just implicit?
Well, when, if they're interacting with their phone, they're definitely awake,
yeah,
right?
I'm are you treating that as ground truth then, in that case? So, I mean, it leaves a fun thing, right, where you can intervene by, say, giving a notification on the phone and seeing how they respond.
Oh, interesting.
Is it deep sleep or not? Like, you have an interesting way of kind of probing them.
Yeah, I guess, no, we didn't do that. That's a cool idea. So it's like, an actual way to, it will only be the ground truth of whether they're awake or not, right? But it's one way to maybe validate it. Yeah, I think the other thing we're trying to do is later is actually do a polysomnography with all the sleep devices. So we actually know what stage of sleep they're in, and we can actually get very detailed numbers of every single device. Those are machines are kind of hard to get a hold of and expensive to rent, but that's one thing we want to do. Any other questions? So that's Sleep Poacher. That was kind of personalized recommendations to improve sleep. But when we're not sleeping, we're creating, hopefully, memories. And so the last system I want to talk about is called Rewind. And this is about, you know, changing how we capture memories. And I'll start the story here with this trip I did. This is to go up to Seattle to start my PhD. And I remember this was like a really great memory because I had packed all my belongings into my car. And that was everything I owned. I sold everything. I was like completely free. I was going to change, you know, from being a software developer to being a PhD student. So that was exciting. And it was like really beautiful. I was driving up in the late summer along the coast on Highway 1. And it was just like looks gorgeous, right? So I was like, oh, it'd be cool to like kind of remember it again. But I didn't take pictures because I was driving. So that's too bad. And so, but the only thing I really have is this map. So I can like look at this map. But it's not really what I experienced. So that's too bad. I found that there's these Street View pictures. So I went on Google, and like you can actually, you know, put your person down here. And this is actually a lot closer to what I remember, right? So there were like wildflowers on the side of the road. There was the ocean on the left and farms on the right. So that actually was a really nice thing to find. And so I was thinking, like, isn't it possible for us to kind of automatically recreate some of these memories from the location data that we have in our phone? So a lot of phones, so all the Android phones by default collect your location data. And so you can actually, if you go back and see, you know, every day what path you took, right? So iOS, the location data, they also collect it somewhere, but you have to root your phone to get access to it. But basically, the phones are collecting the data already. And what can we do if we take your location data and try to regenerate what that past was like? So I'm going to play you a little trailer of the project idea.
Capturing a memory is a fundamental part of human nature. Only 200 years ago, the way we chronicled significant moments in our lives was by writing in journals and diaries. When the film camera was introduced, we learned how to load, wind, focus, set aperture, and exposure. Closer to the present, the smartphone camera equated clicking to capturing a memory. Now, we introduce Rewind, the next evolution in memory media. Simply carrying your phone captures memories for you, allowing you to later rewind and replay your past. Rewinds are automatically generated digital memories created from mobile geolocation data. We collect Google Street View images of the locations in a user's GPS history, then stitch the images together to digitally fabricate a memory. Rewinds are thus created without any active intention from the user.
So basically, yeah, Mary.
So are there, for a Google Street View image for a different place, are there multiple copies of the image from different times of year, like different seasons or daylight conditions or
great question.
Other, or like other people around, events happening?
Yeah. Can I answer it in two slides?
Okay.
Yeah. But that's a good question. So, yeah, so the first step is we take
so
these.
You're not actually taking pictures. You're just looking at Google Street.
Yep.
So it's not like a webcam.
Yeah, it's an extreme example. We're not capturing any. There's no intention behind it. We're just taking the location, and we're getting the Street View images along the path that you took. And we're making it interactive, too. So these are like the Street View images. When you scrub the touchpad kind of back and forth, you go back and forward in time. To your question, Mary, about the conditions, so the thing is, a part of the memory is really important to match the conditions that you saw when you're there, right? If you're walking down somewhere in the middle of the night and you see a Street View picture of it during the day, it's going to be you're not going to feel like that's your memory. So we actually did some very basic image manipulation to try to match those for the time of day, like the afternoon, night, morning kind of thing, the weather conditions. So you can, for a specific location and time, we can figure out what the weather was like at that time. There's a NOAA data set that we have downloaded in our database. We can find the closest weather station, and we know if it's cloudy, windy, rainy, snowy, that kind of thing, right? And so we can make it match that. Actually, this looks way cooler in a video than in a picture because we actually animated the rain and snow, so it really feels like it's falling there. And then even the season. The season we don't have quite right. There's ways to do season like really well, but when we tried those, the state-of-the-art computer vision algorithms take about like 5 to 10 minutes per single image, and we have to do 200 images in a few seconds. So we just do like mainly foliage and like a bit of things. So in the winter, it just looks stupid because the trees are white, but it looks okay for the other seasons. So, and then also there's the idea of sound, right? So if it was windy and we can detect if you're walking or driving, we recreate like the pitter-patter of raindrops if you're walking down the street. And if it was windy, we can do like, depending on the strength of the wind. So this is trying to recreate the experience as close as possible. And so we actually wanted to see if this was somewhat realistic or people actually believed them as memories or remembered the places. So we would kind of bring people in. So we actually ran a study where they went about their day. We had just people from the local population, and they would track their location, come in, and then we would show them kind of rewinds of the past. And so here's like an example of what it looked like when they were looking at it. So this is Waterman Street, and so they're just going up and down kind of this area. It's interactive, so they can kind of travel back and forth in time. So it's kind of made jarring for us, but for the participant, they were just messing around. But this is kind of what it looks like. And so, so 2 weeks of the study population. And here's a couple of interesting findings we got. So the paper's in submission to UBComp right now. But basically, if we show rewinds compared to photos, they're twice as likely to remember those locations in the past. One really interesting thing about memory is a lot of times people were driving, right? And people will often remember the beginning and end of a route, but not anything in between. And we found this effect to be especially pronounced for if people were frequent GPS users. So it seems like there's some kind of effect where you remember where, you can recognize the location where you're beginning because you're trying to kind of navigate. Then you turn on the GPS and you kind of like, your attention just kind of goes elsewhere. Maybe you just like think about research or something for the day. And then when you get there, you kind of recognize, you're like, oh, I'm there, so I need to get out. But then in kind of later on, if a week later, you're not going to remember, the kind of middle of the route at all. So you actually lose that, which is kind of interesting. And we were also looking at, what makes you actually want to keep a memory? And this is a question that we're really interested in. And it turns out if they saw the rewind and there was no strong emotional response, it was just like neutral, they're like, oh, okay, like whatever, then they were very unlikely to want to keep it. You need to have like a strong positive emotion about the memory. Like it has to be like, oh, I remember my grandma's house, and it was like a very specific event. So this is what we call episodic memory. You remember a specific instance of time, whereas things that were more like if they remember kind of the facts, like the semantics of the memory, like this is this location, this is where I went to school, then they didn't really care about as much. And also, this one was a little bit surprising. Even if they didn't like really remember the scene, if there was like a very aesthetically pleasing composition of the image, they would want to keep it. So it was either they needed a strong kind of positive emotion or a very aesthetically pleasing set of images. So that's what we found so far from it. And so basically, I've shown you some systems where we're trying to kind of personalize certain things. We want to change how we, people improve sleep or capture memories. And I want to talk a little bit about, so basically with WebGazer, we use personalized data to track eye gaze. With Drafty, we change how we maintain it, data by kind of hoping to keep it up to date by asking people. With Sleep Coacher, we change how we improve our sleep by making recommendations, so as a kind of cycle of data collection and recommendations. And with Rewind, we want to change how we capture memories. Instead of purely intentional, is we can actually take capture some memories without you having to do anything. And so these, I was kind of going through my guiding principles. And by some standards, we have succeeded, because in terms of like papers, grants, or video demos. But for me, I feel like this is actually not good enough. Because what I've shown you is that these systems have the potential to change how we do things. But we actually haven't changed how people in the world do things around us with these systems. There's more like research prototypes with like nice findings and results. But I feel like the work doesn't end there. So what I really want to do is make things that people actually use, like I mentioned in the beginning, people that don't have to use it because they're part of the study that are actually using it. So changing how things are done with real people. And that required a bit of like introspection. I was thinking, you know, I tried to be really honest with myself of like why these systems are not adopted by more people. And part of it is we need to spend more time to like get them out there and actually making them work really well. But there's also kind of this so there's this kind of gap between the systems that we've dealt as research and what it takes to make them actually desirable products. So I'm trying to do that, and maybe it'll never happen, but I think it's worth putting a substantial amount of effort into it. So what we're doing now, what I call the post-paper era. So we've finished writing the paper. Some of them are published, some of them are in submission. But we want to keep iterating on the systems even after we get the promising results. I think that's important. So here's what we're doing. Now, so with WebGazer, the hard part of improving the accurate, the main thing that we found with WebGazer, people are using it, but it's not quite accurate enough to get to the point where people are using it for like a lot of really legitimate applications, like really important usability studies or games where you can interact with screen user eyes, right? We need to up the accuracy there. And the hard part there is that the webcam is collecting a stream of video that changes every time. So if we think we've improved the accuracy by 5%, we actually can't tell, because each time we show up with a webcam with a different face, with different lighting, a different person. So we're putting together a data set now of about 50 people where we have the video of their face as well as the interactions they do on a web page for a set of standard tasks, as well as we have an infrared eye tracker like a Tobii X3-120 that actually tells us where they were looking. So we have, putting these data sets together, we can then actually try to optimize the webcam eye tracker in a much more rigorous, principled way.
Let me push back a little bit on that.
Yeah.
Imagine you have perfect tracking. Mm-hmm. I think the question still remains, what would you do with it?
Oh.
So you described one, and I think we're getting closer to that. So there are laptops now with built-in gaze trackers that are pretty accurate.
Yeah, I guess.
So, but what would you do with it? You mentioned games.
Yeah. Well, you could make like real-time interact. Any website could, like for example, the New York Times could figure out what you're reading. You could say like, hey, we're gonna figure out what you're reading in exchange for you accessing the New York Times for free. So it opens up a lot of new.
But that's not a great user experience.
Okay. It could be like interactive. Yeah.
So
like website. You could control something without your hands,
doing,
right?
But I think it's not obvious what you would do.
Yeah.
To really leverage that.
Okay, that's fair. So, but maybe I think once we get there, people will actually develop applications on the top. So that would be kind of cool to see. But maybe you're right. Maybe nothing will happen and it'll just be, kind of a dud.
I think games is good. Because errors don't happen.
Yeah. For Sleep Coacher, we're actually going to run what I call a 10-year sleep study, which sounds scary. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to participate in this study for 10 years. But actually more of a philosophy that we want to have it running up. We're going to keep it up and running for 10 years so anyone can go in and have kind of a lifetime improvement of sleep, right? So it tells you how to improve your sleep constantly, because you have to run basically these one-month experiments for each kind of condition. And so 10 years gives you ample time to basically optimize your sleep as best as possible. So after 10 years, we think you're going to be sleeping as well as you could with the aid of the app. So we're going to start that soon. If you sign up on the website, we'll send you the beta apps, and you can sign up and actually make your sleep better, hopefully. So that's kind of the next step. For Rewind, right now we have a research prototype, but it's not clear how to like get your location data and everything. So we're actually preparing a self-service kind of web application for that. That's more straightforward. And the last one is for Drafty. We're releasing Giraffe as a platform, so like you can use host any kind of data set on it. So there's some ideas we've had, like a data set of applying for scholarships, right? So that's like a set of data that changes every year that people find very valuable, but it's really hard to maintain a central data set for. So we're trying to release it as a platform so more people can actually host their own data on it and we can actually see what happens. So these are kind of the post-paper steps that we're doing right now. So that's what we're doing at Brown. This work is done by a lot of students, actually a lot of undergraduate students too. So all of your papers have undergrad co-authors, and that's all I want to say. But so thanks for coming. Yeah, Adam.
I had a question about Rewind.
Yeah.
I meant to ask before you sort of transitioned there.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the people were responding to it a little differently than they were to their own photos. And I was wondering if you had considered combining the two experiences. So, as an example, I recently went to Hawaii and I drove around the island of Oahu. And I have pictures of all these different beaches, parks, and things like that, which are great, but I don't have a good capture of the very beautiful scenery that you sort of encounter as you're driving around the island. And what's interesting is that I uploaded these photos to, in this case, Google Photos, and it automatically produced this travel journal, right? It says, here's the map, and here's where all the photos were taken. And it was really clever, but I still missed out on sort of that dash cam view of getting
right.
from one point to the other. And so I was just wondering if you had thought about ways of integrating personal documents and personal memories with this sort of synthesized memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen the Google thing too. I think it's like there's a Google Plus like stories kind of feature
or
something.
Yeah, there's a number of different
things. Yeah, so definitely like combining with your own photos makes the most sense, right? Because you can get the best of both worlds, like actual photos you have with people in it, and also maybe the stuff during the journey, right? So you don't just have the endpoints or the landmarks. So I think that's probably the final version of it. I think as for research, it's probably easier to just do like an extreme version, see what's possible with the just user interaction, explicit interaction at all, and see what you can get if it's actually useful then. If it's not useful without the photos, then it's probably not a good thing to just add to the photos.
And in the work that you did, you sort of compared the sort of just photos condition with Google Street View condition, is that correct?
Yeah, so we did the Rewinds versus photos for everyone. We also added, it was like a mixed methods interview, so we asked both, or semi-structured interviews, so we asked both specific questions and also wanted to know more about their experience. I think the main purpose is just to see if they remembered those places, if they believed that they were real memories, and if they were desirable, like if they wanted to keep them as their own memories.
Well, I mean, I think it's really clever idea.
Will you generate false memories? What's that?
Yeah, exactly. All those people walking by.
Yeah.
Or they're random construction.
I think there was a case where we loaded like the wrong person's memory in, and then that person still seemed to like remember that thing. So, but the other is more common. It's like that we show them places that they've been, and they say they haven't been there. That's way more common. Thanks. Any other?
Memories while are people creeped out by the amount of information the device knows about them? Like, I feel like most people, like, kind of don't realize that the device is tracking everything about their location. Mm-hmm. But showing that to people.
Yeah.
Did people react to that?
I think when we told them that most devices are already doing it, they were surprised, but I don't think anyone was, like, super negatively surprised because they were coming here to do a study where we tracked their location. So I think it's probably a self-selecting population of people that were okay with it, or like pleasantly surprised. They're like, hey, this is so cool. So I think there's like, the factor of like, hey, this is cool. But then there's sometimes the factor of like, oh my God, I can't believe he has data from like 7 years ago. That was the other big reaction.
Also, I mean, how many of them were just undergraduate students anyway who might have a different sense of privacy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For Rewind, we just used the local populations. It was it was very representative of people in Providence. Any last question?
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Right. Jeff is around for the rest of today. I think you actually have a little time now free.
Yeah,
and
then I'm meeting with Mary
and
Paul.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.